Okay. So first of all, I'd like to thank the Perimeter Institute for inviting me over for this week, and I hope it'll be exciting. And as a starter, I would like to give this talk on topological order and a way of classifying and arranging different types of topological order in a coherent framework. So let me start by giving you a brief outline of what I'm going to talk about. So I will briefly remind you about what topological order actually is and how it is useful for quantum computation. And as a very simple example, I will briefly touch the toric code in a way that should be understandable for everyone, even though there is no background on topological order. Then I will come to the first part of the classifying scheme, which we call the electromagnetic duality. And again, I will motivate this in the example of the toric code. And then, starting here with this non-abelian landscape, I will actually turn to review my own work. And this will go on with a certain hierarchy of states that we found. And for that, I will introduce briefly the concept of tensor network states and our version of that, which we call the Hopf tensor network states. And using this framework, I will show you how one can actually arrange topological states in a hierarchy. And then I will come to the summary, and if there is time, there might be some bonus material. Okay, so let's start with the concept of topological order and why it is useful to talk to a quantum information audience about topological order. Well, first of all, this picture here really nicely captures the whole story behind topological order. So this is something I took from a version from Scientific American. And what you can basically see here is some types of quasi-particles you find in a two-dimensional medium. And this is really what it boils down to when you talk about topological order. So it turns out that in two dimensions, there is more than just fermions and bosons. There is exotic exchange statistics, and these particles that have exotic exchange statistics are called anions. And then you see here a couple of threads originating from each of these quasi-particles, and they are supposed to depict the world lines of these particles. So the hands that are actually weaving this braid would correspond to, well, a physicist in the lab having sufficient control over these quasi-particles and moving them around each other, braiding their world lines in a certain way. And as it turns out, for some quasi-particles, the braiding of their world lines gives you not just a phase, not just something which is beyond -1 or +1 for fermions or bosons, but in certain cases you actually get a whole unitary maps on the space of these quasi-particles just by using their topological interaction, just by forming braids of their world lines. Of course, this only works if you really do have a stage on which these quasi-particles can really perform their dance. So what one needs is one needs a physical system which actually has topological features, so which is a vacuum from which you can excite these quasi-particles with anionic behavior. And in this talk, what I'll do is I will focus on a discretized version of that. So I will focus on spin systems that implement topological order. And I will specifically talk about certain fixed points of topological order. Now let's come to a very simple model of topological order called the toric code. You've probably all heard about that before. So it is just a lattice that you embed in a torus, and you place qubits on the edges of the links of this graph. And qubits are just 0 and 1, and if you want to say it in an abstract way, you can just say, okay, it's from the group Z2 where you actually draw the degrees of freedom. Then, as the Hamiltonian, you use this operator, which has a sum structure and two parts. So one part is associated to the vertices of your lattice. These are the A operators. There is one in the Hamiltonian for each vertex. And there are also operators that are associated to the faces of your lattice. And what do they actually look like? Well, this is how they look like. If you think of each red point representing a Pauli X operator and each blue point a Pauli Z operator, this is basically what these operators look like. So this is just a loop of X operators around each vertex. And the face operators consist of the same thing around faces, but with Pauli X's replaced by Pauli Z's. And if you look at this closely, it turns out that, in fact, all these operators commute with each other, and they can actually be made projectors. So in the end, you will have a Hamiltonian, which is a sum of mutually commuting projectors, and one knows that this is exactly solvable, of course. And, well, one can get a glimpse of why this model is topological by studying its ground state space, and more specifically by saying that this is actually a stabilizer code. Because it turns out that the operators in the Hamiltonian that you've just seen are just stabilizer operators. Now, of course, the question is, what are the encoded qubits of your stabilizer code? And for that, you need to look for operators that commute with your stabilizer group, but which are actually not part of this stabilizer group. And if you look on the torus and within the Hamiltonian of the toric code, you will find that, for example, this is one operator that does commute with the Hamiltonian, but cannot be generated neither from the vertex nor from the face operators. So let us just say this would define one logical qubit in the Z basis. And in fact, you can find some more operators which also act on the logical subspace of this stabilizer code. For example, this one here, which is a string of X operators arranged along a dual path on this lattice. And as you can see, the overlap between these two logical operators is just a single edge, a single qubit. And from there, you see that these two logical operators inherit the commutation relations of the Pauli operators. So this indeed defines one qubit. But this is not the whole story. Of course, you can find in the horizontal direction, again, a Z-type logical operator, where this is a string of Z Paulis along a direct path of the lattice. And basically, by the same token as before, you will find in the vertical direction a logical X operator. And it really turns out that these are the only operators up to equivalence classes which really do influence your logical subspace. This, of course, holds for the torus. And you see that if we look at the ground state, the encoded subspace, that this is really a tensor product of two qubits. Now, you might ask yourself, what happens if I change the properties of the underlying surface? So what happens if I put this lattice with that Hamiltonian not on a torus, but on something else? So let's put that on a sphere. And it turns out that suddenly the code becomes useless because it doesn't encode any logical qubit. And the reason for that is that the very fact that the logical operators commute with the Hamiltonian but are not generated by the individual terms in the Hamiltonian comes from the fact that you're actually using the fundamental loops of the torus. And as you know, the sphere has a trivial fundamental group, so you will not find any closed loop that you cannot contract to a single point. Hence, you have no such logical operators. Hence, you just have a single ground state of the toric code on a sphere, and you have no stabilizer code. And in that sense, you already see that the toric code is sensitive to topological features of your model, namely of the underlying surface. Okay, so far we've been looking at closed loops on the direct and the dual lattice, and we've seen that these are logical operators. Now let's actually break these closed loops apart and see what happens then. And this brings us more towards the physics of topological order, namely to quasi-particle excitations. And it will turn out that there are several types of quasi-particles. The trivial one, where there actually is no quasi-particle, and you're, in fact, in the current state of the toric code. But then if you, for example, place this particular open string of Z operators on the graph, you will see that this operator violates at the endpoints the vertex stabilizers, and you create excitations because you pay an energy penalty. And these quasi-particles are commonly called electric excitations. And of course, you can play the same game vice versa. If you use an open X string, and you will get so-called magnetic excitations. And of course, you can do two things at the same time and bring magnetic and electric charges close together such that they live on a face and a neighboring vertex. And this is called eidaionic excitation because it combines electric and magnetic charges. So I told you in the beginning that topological order is really about the behavior of quasi-particles under exchange. And this can be very well illustrated here in the simple example of the toric code. And this is what you will see now. So let us suppose we have an empty canvas in the beginning, and then we create, via these two string operators, two pairs of quasi-particles. So these will be magnetic excitations, and these will be electric excitations. And then we start braiding one type of excitation around the other one. For example, like this. So this particle encircles the other one. And you see that if it does a full revolution around this electric excitation, at some point it will inevitably cross this blue string of Z. So in fact, these two strings interact in exactly this edge here, non-trivially. And it turns out that if you compare the state psi that we had in the beginning with the state we get after one full braiding, so after, in fact, two exchanges, one exchange and another exchange, you see that the wave function acquires a minus sign. And this is, well, exotic, because if these particles were mutual bosons or fermions, you would have, after two exchanges, a plus one phase in any case. But you don't, you have a minus phase, and this is why these particles are called anions, and in fact they're called semions here. Okay, after this motivation, let us continue with the electric-magnetic duality. And I couldn't resist bringing a classical analogy. So you see here that in Maxwell's equations, the individual fields, the electric and the magnetic field, are actually fully dual to each other, if we, for a moment, don't care about the minus sign here. But what happens if we add charges? What happens if we add the sources of these fields? And then we will see that the symmetry is suddenly broken. Well, we see that there are electric monopoles, but here there is nothing like magnetic monopoles. Now, you know that if you take a magnet and if you break it apart, and if you try to just get a north pole and a south pole, that won't work. You will just get smaller magnets again. Now, wouldn't it be nice if, in fact, you had magnetic monopoles? Well, it seems that in spin ice, you can actually have that as emergent excitations. And this analogy, so this symmetry or duality between electric and magnetic excitations or sources, was actually our guiding principle for for finding a duality in topological order, where you can also exchange the magnetic and the electric sector. And how this works, I will demonstrate briefly in the example of the toric code. So this is material that has been known for quite some years. And I will just try and give you a brief insight why electromagnetic duality works in this case and why it doesn't directly work in the more general case. So again, we here have the lattice, the solid lines, and the dual lattice are dashed lines. Then here, for simplicity, I've just drawn one of the degrees of freedom. And as I told you, these are drawn from Z2. And, well, this here means that for the moment we are still on the direct lattice. Then, just as far as the Hilbert space is concerned, we can apply at every edge a Hadamard gate and simultaneously rotate this edge from the direct lattice to the dual lattice and, so to speak, reinterpret our Hilbert space by dualizing the lattices. And, well, on the other side, we still have a qubit degree of freedom. Now, what does this have to do with the toric code? Well, we can look at how operators transform. So let us look at vertex operators, where these are products of Pauli X's. And under a Hadamard conjugation, of course, they turn into Pauli Z's. And you see that, in fact, a vertex operator in the original lattice has turned into a phase operator in the new lattice. And we can continue the game and say, well, what happens to the phase operators in the original? And, of course, under the Hadamard transformation, they are turned into vertex operators in the new lattice. Then, if we want to look at the situation where these stabilizer operators are actually broken, we will end up with a situation like this. So an electric charge would violate the vertex stabilizer and the magnetic charge would violate a phase stabilizer. And you can see that under Hadamard, all X's and Z's are again changed. And in fact, the violations also kind of change their character. They change their character from electric to magnetic, and vice versa. Okay, now you also see, well, that you have, in fact, two perfectly valid copies of the toric code on the left and on the right-hand side. Now, I want to tell you a little secret about that. Namely, the identification works, in fact, in two steps, and this will be crucial for the generalization. If you want to go from the toric code or abelian models to non-abelian models. So I don't want to go into the details, but the secret behind this mapping is that you first go to the dual lattice, but that you don't keep the degrees of freedom in Z2 in the group, but you put the degrees of freedom into the functions from this group to the complex numbers. Okay, so this at the moment just looks like an abstract game, right? Because you all know that this thing here is isomorphic to the group itself. So, well, what's the point of this? Well, the point of this is that this isomorphism from here to here holds for any abelian group. So basically, electromagnetic duality for a topological order in abelian groups has been known. And this is the situation. So A here says that we have an abelian group, and the D says that, well, we take the quantum double of that, which basically means that in this abelian case, we have as many electric as magnetic quasi-particle excitations. So to speak, we overlap two sectors. And the example I just showed you is the toric code, and we've seen here that the toric code is perfectly self-dual under this mapping. And I've tried to convince you that this holds for all abelian groups. Now, of course, it has also been long known how to generalize the toric code itself to abelian groups, and this has been a magnificent work by Alexei Kitaev. And in this way, this landscape up until here has been known. As the next thing, I will give you a brief sketch of what these generalized quantum doubles are about. But in fact, I won't go in any detail. But I would just like to outline kind of the main differences that you will find in the end. So the model here is again based on a graph. You put this time qubits on the links of the graph. They have to be oriented. And these qubits, in fact, are elements from the group G that you chose to base your model on. Then, as far as the Hamiltonian is concerned, functionally it has the exact same form as the Hamiltonian for the toric code. So again, it is a sum of vertex terms and a sum of phase terms, and they mutually commute. They can be chosen to be projectors. The system is exactly solvable. But the qualitative difference shows up in the quasi-particle excitations. So again, we have the topologically trivial sector where no quasi-particle whatsoever can be found. But then, in general, the excitations are mixtures. So they are, in general, dions. So you cannot separate electric and magnetic quasi-particles from each other, not in general. And the reason behind this is that you actually have to use a ribbon kind of operator to excite a pair of quasi-particles from the ground state, and it's not enough to just look at two separate paths of operators. And the main difference also is that if you do braiding with these particles, you actually get much more than you would get in the toric code. But I will come to that in a second. Hear me now. So what happens if we braid these guys? So again, we excite from the vacuum two pairs of quasi-particles, and we call this the state psi. And now we let one of these quasi-particles walk around the other one. Here we have performed one exchange of particles. We now go on to perform a full exchange, a double exchange, in fact. And it turns out when you analyze this situation that what you get is you, in fact, get a unitary rotation on the state you started with. And that's because, again, this ribbon path that encircles this particle here has to cross the other ribbon, and because these operators are more complicated, it's the interaction of these operators crossing here are in fact more general than just giving you a unitary phase. But they give you, in fact, a whole linear map. Now, I want to quickly introduce kind of the diagrammatic way of looking at the situation. So abstractly, what you do is you create two pairs of quasi-particles from the vacuum. So vacuum are lines that we just do not draw. And in most cases, there are actually particle-antiparticle pairs. And then the first step consists in just exchanging these particles once. And if you look closely, it's exactly this world line that crosses in front of the other one. That's just what has happened here in this braiding. And then we do it again. And all particles have returned to their original positions, but we have acquired a unitary operation on that. Okay. So far, this is just a different way of drawing this, but I would like you to keep this in mind because this will become important in a few minutes. So let's return to our landscape of dualities. So I've just told you about the situation that has been known so far. This is whatever you find here in this rectangle. Now, because of this full unitary map that you get from the braiding, it turns out that already the simplest model based on the group S3, so the simplest non-abelian group, gives you the power to do quantum computation. And this model can be found here. And now the obvious question is, well, is there some kind of electric magnetic duality in the non-abelian case as well? And well, this is where my work began. And if you think about it, it becomes clear relatively quickly that this dual path now has to be outside here, because on a non-abelian group, the functions on this group are just not isomorphic to the group itself. So you have to look outside. And this is exactly what we did. And you can find it in this paper here, where we define a new class of models based on an algebraic structure which is known as Hopf algebras. And the rough picture of that is that we just enlarge the space of available models, where everything that has been known so far is contained. And by doing that, we can, in fact, identify another class of models that are based on groups, namely where you use the function algebras. And it turns out that within this class, you just find the dual partner of non-abelian quantum double models. So I won't tell you about the details of how we do this, but it is slightly non-trivial to do this, because you have to really understand and use the structure you find in these Hopf algebras. And I also won't tell you about Hopf algebras themselves, what they are. I'm just going to give you a quick glimpse on what the main structure is you find there that we use. But in order to complete this duality landscape, we also have examples of models which are way different from models that are based on groups. And we also know they are their dual partners outside. And sometimes it also happens that you find self-dual models which are completely outside here. And for example, there is a Hopf algebra called H8, which is eight-dimensional, which is precisely an example of a self-dual model of this more general type. And then for those of you who might know about string net models and might wonder how they fit into the picture, well, we have a conjecture that, in fact, if you generalize this a little further, then the whole square here will, in fact, be all string net models that you can find, including doubled Fibonacci's and so on. But it will be a certain completion of these string net models. And this is what we call the extended string net models. And we conjecture that also on these extended models, you will get dualities of all sorts. So you will get dual partners which do not coincide. And, well, yeah, you will also get self-dual ones.
Dual now? Because when it's self-dual, you just want to understand what the dual means. What does it mean? What is conserved in the duality?
What self-dual means?
No. Well, when you have a duality between this element in the G and this element in the FG,
yes.
What does it mean that they're dual?
Oh, it means that you can find a direct identification between the Hamiltonians. So it doesn't mean, for example, that they are in the same phase. But it's just an algebraic relation that translates between this model and the other model.
Which conserves what? So they have the same grading statistics?
Well, for example, in... well, you can analyze the quasi-particles and then how they transform under that. We haven't done this, but we will look into this. Of course, I mean, you will, in the non-abelian case, you will expect that if you take pure electric and pure magnetic charges, that they will be more or less interchanged, but you have to be more careful with the dynamic sector. But this is something we will still look into. Okay, so let me get back to this drawing lines business. And actually, let's talk about symmetry briefly. So symmetry is a very, very important concept in physics. It goes back to Wigner and his group symmetry, and it's used in quantum chromodynamics. It's really used everywhere. And the concept is that you can classify particles as representations of some algebraic object. For example, as representations of groups. And spins, for example, you classify as certain irreducible representations of SU2, and you get spin 1/2, spin 1, and so forth. And, well, what does it in fact mean to talk about particles as irreducible representations? Well, you take a group element, and you act on the particle, the irrep. If you have two particles, as in this case, and if you want to apply a global symmetry, you have to, in fact, split this group element into two, and then you perform a simultaneous rotation on both of these particles. Now, once you're interested in the exchange statistics, you will draw lines like this. So you will exchange the particle world lines, and then if you keep acting with a global symmetry on them, what do you do? So here, this group element, this copy here, acts on that one, and this acts on that one. And now if you exchange these two irreps, then, well, you have to also exchange the elements that act on them to follow them synchronously. But as you can see, because the left and the right side are completely identical, nothing non-trivial happens. You just exchange them and you find the same situation as you had before. Now, there are cases where you can define such a splitting operation in a meaningful way, and meaningful means you require a certain set of axioms and that fit all together consistently. And what you end up with is a generalization of a group to a Hopf algebra, and you can still look at irreducible representations of this algebraic object. And of course, you can look at the symmetries that you find if you apply a Hopf algebra on particles. Now, the crucial difference here is that if you split such an element of a Hopf algebra into two, you won't get just a copy, but you will get a left and a right part in this symbolic notation here. So just keep in mind that one prime means the left part and two primes means the right part. The sum is a symbolic notation. It has a well-defined meaning, but I don't want to dive into this. Now, the interesting thing is, if you do the same thing and exchange the particles, so if you exchange the irreps like this, you also have to exchange the left and the right part that acts on the respective particle. But now, since the left and the right part in generally are not the same thing, something non-trivial happens once you exchange the particles. And this is the reason why, if you deal with anionic systems, with the particles with exotic exchange statistics, this is the right symmetry you have to look for. Okay, so this is basically all I'm going to tell you about Hopf algebras, and really keep in mind the splitting that I will use now heavily. Okay, so let's now get to the hierarchy. And the idea behind this is we construct quantum many-body states via tensor networks and a certain extension that we put forward. And one then finds special states in this general framework that in fact make up this hierarchy of topological states. So let me briefly tell you about the traditional approach that people have taken to tensor network states. So the way that works is you have a graph edge. you have a physical degree of freedom, a qubit, a qubit, whatever, that sits on this graph edge. And then you assign a tensor to this graph edge. And this tensor has also virtual indices, alpha, beta, gamma, and delta. And so this this red point will indicate the physical index throughout. And then what you can do is, well, you can start taking more of these tensors and start contracting them like this. And basically with each tensor, the graph edge appears. And then you continue this, and you contract and contract, all the way until you've contracted all tensors that you find on your lattice. And the result is a number. So the result is something where you can put into these red boxes your physical indices. So all your x1 to, well, the number of edges you have in your lattice. And because this is then fully contracted, you will get a number from this. So it is some sort of generalized trace operation. And what people do in the tensor networks, they just interpret this as the amplitude of the quantum state they want to construct. And this has been a very, very successful approach, which has been pioneered by the paper of AKLT and has been then used in MPS. It has been shown that the famous DMRG algorithms, in fact, use MPS states, or matrix product states, as their variational wave functions. And these are just one-dimensional versions of this. And what you see here is a two-dimensional version called projected entangled pair states. But it is really about contracting tensors and interpreting the result as a wave function amplitude. And, well, from that you can construct a state. Now, what we did is we basically take the same concept of using local objects and putting them together in a meaningful way in order to get a full quantum state. But what we do is we use not just bare tensors without any structure, but we use a Hopf algebra and the structures that the Hopf algebra gives us for free. And this is really the key idea. We get certain structures for free, and we just need to exploit them and get topological states like that. And I just want to give you a brief glimpse of how we do that. So this is really our atomic building block of our tensor network approach. So X is now an element from our Hopf algebra, and F is an element of the dual. So it is just a function from the Hopf algebra to the numbers. And then this diagram piece here just means take this function and evaluate this function at the element X. So this is just a number. So then we go on and use the splitting of the Hopf algebra that we get for free. So this is just the symbolic notation here. But note that we use the left part of the splitting of X in this upper diagram, and we use the second part in this lower diagram. And again, what you see is you just see a complex number, because this is a function evaluation just as is the lower one. So now we have split the whole X into two pieces, but we can also split it in three pieces or in four. If we just apply this splitting many times in a serial way. And now what we do is, now we start writing down, in fact, a vector in a Hilbert space. And for that, we use the first part of this X. And then here, we use the second part in this upper diagram part and the third part in this blob here. And in order to not all the time have to use these three parts, we can also contract this and write this in a more compact way, which means whatever we split, we keep one part in the physical cat, in the vector, and we use the other part in these diagrams. And these diagrams will eventually play something analogous to a wave function amplitude. Okay, so I will now drop these indices, but keep in mind that we do this business here for each and every edge, and that these functions are always associated with these black lines that come out of the red boxes. Okay, so using, again, the structures of a Hopf algebra, there is a meaningful way of, in fact, putting two such loop pieces together to form a larger loop. And all we have to do is we have to use this gluing operation repeatedly until we fill the whole lattice with such a diagram, which effectively we just built from this very small building block that you have seen in the beginning. And then in the end, we get a state. And this state is parameterized by basically two parts. So it is parameterized by our choice of Hopf algebra elements, which we can, in principle, take arbitrary for each and every edge. And these are the ones which we then split and by this method that I've just shown you use in the diagram. And the other part is for each loop that we have, we can choose, in principle, a different function from the Hopf algebra to the complex number. And in that way, we can use these things here as variational parameters and get a whole class of wave functions.
Because, so you're summing over the x I, but x I is also a label on the left hand side. I'm just, is it the index?
Oh, okay, so as I said, this is a symbolic notation that initially, Sweet notation, yeah, that looks a bit intimidating or strange in the beginning, but it's just a shorthand, so you shouldn't really think of this as a sum. At the start, but you just you should think of this as kind of keeping track of what are the things that you split. Okay, so it just means for each xi that you put in here, you split it into many parts, and then for each edge, you use the first part of the splitting here, and the rest goes into the diagram. Okay, and then I said, this is sort of a wave function amplitude, because if you think, for example, about the group case where these x's are in fact group elements, then you remember that the splitting is just take g to the tensor product of g times g. So you will just have a g here, and the same g here for each edge in this wave function, and there will be no entanglement or no link between a first and a second part here. But here it is really intertwined because we do this non-trivial split. Okay, and now it turns out if you start investigating this large class of variational wave functions that we built from these Hopf algebra structures, it turns out if you just pick the right xi's and the right fp's, the right function, you will end up with this here. Okay, so now let me explain what this means. This means that here we have the Hopf algebra, so basically along this path here, we can make discrete choices of these xi, of these Hopf algebra elements, and by the way, we take the same one everywhere. And along this axis here, we have the dual of the Hopf algebra. So along here, we really make different choices for the Fs that we use in the construction. And it turns out that every Hopf algebra with certain properties that we need, like unitarity, for example, has a unique element, which is canonical and has very, very nice properties, and it's called the Haar integral. And then, of course, if each and every Hopf algebra has that, then of course every subalgebra of a given Hopf algebra will also have, its own canonical element, its own canonical Haar integral. And in this way, it is clear that if we use Hopf subalgebra A, and every time choose that very canonical element, and if we do the same thing on the dual, and use the canonical element in the dual subalgebra, we get this discrete set of states. Okay? And, well, what does this have to do with the models I showed you before, with the landscape? Well, the connection is that if you remember this larger box that we introduced, where we said, okay, these are the generalized Pitayev models based on Hopf algebra, then it turns out that this very state here at the top of this hierarchy is in fact a ground state of such a generalized quantum double model. And then it turns out, if you look at the other end, that here you will just find a product state. It is really just the generalization of a plus state. And now you can start asking about what do you find in between. And you might also wonder about the colors here. Well, you know that a product state is the least entangled thing you can think of. And you also know that there is some intricate entanglement in the ground states of topologically ordered systems. And in fact, there is a number that is supposed to characterize this. This is called gamma. And well, in this red part, the gamma is as high as it can get in this hierarchy. And wherever there is blue, this gamma is zero, which is an indicator of you don't have any non-trivial topological order. You just have, well, local symmetry breaking, nothing fancy. But in between, it turns out that you can get values in between. So in some sense, you can interpolate in discrete steps the kind of the amount, if you will, of topological order you can find in these states. And it is pretty reasonable to assume that if you go from here to there, so if you change color, if you change this gamma, that you will actually hit a quantum phase transition, and that for sure different colors will be in different phases, although the same colors could be in the same phase, they could not, so this is something that still needs to be analyzed. Then there is another thing, namely the mechanism that is behind this hierarchy. So what is the physical reason? Well, I wrote here charge condensation because what happens is that here you have the full spectrum of topological charges. So, for example, in the toric coat case, you would have the electric, the magnetic, the dionic excitations, and the respective generalization. And then it turns out in the more general models, if you hop from here to there, some of these particles will actually be absorbed into the ground state. They will become part of the ground state. They will kind of form a Bose condensate, and they will disappear from the free quasi-particles, the free topological charges you can see in your theory. And this is what happens in this hierarchy. And if you end up here in the very product state, this means that you have managed a complete charge condensation, so you have managed to make all quasi-particles disappear into the ground state. And we can actually see this from the symmetry pattern these states exhibit. So, let me mention in a few words what this topological entanglement entropy is about. So what would this measure here that we use to color this hierarchy of states? Well, this is a peculiar correction of the block entropy. So if you think of such a topological medium, and if you take a knife and carve out a certain region, and if you then look at the entanglement that you find between this region and the rest, you will find that in these states and in topological order in general, you will have an area law. So that means this entanglement scales with the boundary of the region you cut out, but not quite, because there is a universal additive correction, namely this gamma value. So it is just slightly below an area law. And this, of course, is an asymptotic statement. So usually you would have some microscopic variations here for small boundaries. But if you then make the region really large and the boundary large as well, then asymptotically you will approach this line here, which is given by the area law and this correction. And it turns out that, in fact, these models exactly lie on this line because they are fixed points. And so this is the measure we use here to characterize different topological orders. Okay, so let me just get to the summary. So the main point of this talk was that I've shown you how we introduced a landscape of electromagnetic duality for non-abelian models. So this hasn't been known before. And in passing, what we've done is we've extended the Kitaev's model, the quantum double models, from groups to something more general. Then I've shown you that, as far as states are concerned, we have developed a new framework of tensor network states that are based on the peculiar structures of Hopf algebras. And then using this framework, we could demonstrate that there is, in fact, a hierarchy of topological quantum states that you can construct locally and then characterize completely. And if you are interested and want to read on this, then these are the two references the talk is based on. So the first one is, in fact, about the tensor network formalism with Hopf algebras. The second one gives you the details about the duality result. And these are other works that are kind of related in that they, for example, give you an identification between string nets and quantum doubles and, well, in general, other tensor network constructions. And with this, I would like to thank you. And
are there questions?
I have one question. So, can we define Planck's Hamiltonian in the same way as the particular space?
Yes, you can do. Yeah, you can do that.
And how do you do that?
Well, I mean, you basically do the same thing. I mean, we haven't carried it out explicitly. But I mean, you just make sure that the right subspaces are annihilated by the Hamiltonian. So you pick like density matrices, and you make sure these are annihilated by the Hamiltonians locally, and then you can prove that if you have like overlapping density matrices, that the whole thing fits together nicely, and that you can in fact define your current Hamiltonian.
And this Hamiltonian is still locally interacting, or
yes, they are. And in fact, it turns out that the Hamiltonians that are associated to this hierarchy, if you just take the group case, so if you just take this hierarchy, so this will take a few seconds. Maybe it's quicker if I just go directly. Yes, so if you look at this thing here, so in fact what we've done is we've defined this hierarchy, all of this rectangle here. And it turns out that there is some previous work by Hector von Wien that is concerned with this rectangle here. And he devised, some modified quantum number modes. They also show charge condensation. And in fact, we learned about this afterwards. So after we identified these special elements in these Hopf algebras and saw then how the symmetry of the resulting state looks like, mm-hmm. and then we saw, oh yeah, actually Hector had already done this in the case of the group. And these Hamiltonians are perfectly local. And it is nice to see that with two very different approaches, one actually gets to the same result. And so this can be seen here as a generalization of what Hector had done before. And if you just do this parent Hamiltonian construction, you will see that this will naturally extend the Hamiltonians that Hector had defined.
So we can just replace the group symmetry by Hopf algebra, then?
Yes, in some sense, yes. But there is a little catch. I mean, there is quite a layer of complexity that you add if you go from a group to a Hopf algebra, because many, many things that you take for granted in calculations with a group are no longer true. Right. And you really have to go the extra mile. But I hope I have convinced you that it's worth taking the extra mile, because you gain this duality landscape, and you gain in this much larger rectangle, you gain this picture of hierarchy. And in fact, you gain an ordering principle of how different types of topological order are in fact related.
So do you have any concrete examples of things in this outer ring?
In this outer ring?
Yeah.
Well, for example, there are the doubled Fibonacci models. Mm-hmm. At the moment, we cannot really attack them with our methods.
Okay. So the doubled Fibonacci model. So it's where's the regular Fibonacci model?
Oh, it's not inside this rectangle at all, because this entire rectangle, so if you will, the whole space of string net models are non-chiral models. So in some sense, you always have two copies of your anion spectrum.
I see.
Two copies of a chiral anion model that is kind of glued together with the original and the dual spectrums in some sense. And you get a non-chiral phase. Whereas if you just take just the Fibonacci, then you will end up with a chiral phase. And this framework here just deals with the double topological order, so with all non-chiral topological phases. Yes. And well, the reason why we cannot attack at the moment these Fibonacci string net models is the quantum dimension of these Fibonaccis are not integral, so they are in fact rational numbers. And this means that these irreducible representations do have fractional dimensions in a certain well-defined way. And this makes it very complicated to deal with. But our conjecture is that if we find a way to tackle them, then this duality will continue to hold, and this duality will, in fact, relate all the non-chiral phases, which the string net models are supposed to be, via this electric pneumatic duality. And, well, we do have an idea how we can actually go from here to here, but this is a work in progress, and this involves some heavy machinery from category theory.
Any further questions?